Hi, Russell Friedman, Western Mass.
Hey, Russell.
I think after people sign in, if I, may I interrupt, please? After people sign in, please do star six because the line is already bad tonight. Say your names if you haven't said them already.
Joy first.
Hi, Joy. Anyone else who hasn't said their name?
Gina Gear with Not One More Acre.
Hey, Jean.
Hey.
Barbara Adams.
Good.
Hello.
Anyone else? It's just in my on my watch at least. It's just now turning nine. So, hello, who's this?
Yeah, I'm Chris in Falls Church, Virginia.
Hi. Who is that?
Hello.
Please say your names.
Chris.
Chris. Okay.
Yes, Chris in Falls Church, Virginia.
Yes, I got that. Thank you.
Mark Levin.
Hey, Mark.
Hi.
Hi, Ruth from Columbia, Maryland.
What was your name, first name?
Ruth.
Thank you. Anyone else who hasn't said their name? It sounded like you were having a good time talking to each other before I... got on, so it was. Was there something? Guess you can't get back to that. Oh, who is this? Hello. Do you want to say your name?
Hello.
Hello. Who's this?
This is Dan in Phoenix. Is it started yet?
We've never heard of you. Hi, Dan.
You guys are weird.
No, we're all being good, Dan. That's what's happening.
What's that?
I said we're all being good and quiet.
That's why I was so quiet. I didn't know what was going on. Okay. I will mute and just wait for instructions here.
Okay. Andrea's going to give some when we give her the go-ahead. It's really just 9 o'clock. It seems like maybe we should wait a couple minutes. Or maybe it's 9:01. We are waiting for some special person, right, Virginia?
Yes.
Our main speaker has not. Is Medea Benjamin on the line yet?
Yes, I've been on. I've just been on mute.
Hi, Medea.
Hey, Medea.
Hi.
That always makes the coordinators feel relieved. Very good of you to be on tonight. Do you want to say what state you're in tonight? Are you in California?
No, I'm in Washington, D.C.
Okay. Give them hell.
She always does.
Okay, well, this is Virginia Hoffler. I'd like to welcome everyone to the call. I think we should get started with Andrea. You're going to tell us all how to get into the chat room and into the forum so we can ask questions, make comments, put up links as we go along tonight.
Thank you.
We should just instruct some people to do star six so that the line stays as clear as possible. That's muting. And then when you want to unmute, you do star six again and you can talk.
Okay, thank you, Virginia and Sally. My name is Andrea Miller, and I have two roles with PDA. I'm the IT director, so I'm responsible for the websites, and I'm also deputy field director. So I'm going to put on my IT hat first, and for those who are at a computer and would like to go into the chat room, you can go to our newest website, which is pdacommunity.org. Now, I'll tell you now, it's going to take a little while for the site to load. It's got a lot of articles and a lot of tools. That site is pdacommunity.org. When you get to the site, on the right-hand side, there's gray bars, and near the top, it says Issue Teams, End Wars and Occupations. Every one of our issue teams has their own chat room. And so if you go to the End Wars and Occupations page and scroll down after the lovely pictures of Sally and Virginia, you'll see the agenda for tonight. And then I see people coming into the chat room. If you keep scrolling down right below the agenda, you'll see the End Wars and Occupations chat room. So as we're going along, if you have any questions, you can type them right in the chat room. Now, you can sign into the chat room with your Facebook account, a Twitter account, or if you don't want to use either one of those, you can just click on guest, type in your name, and sign in as a guest. We've got 11 people online, so this is really, really good. If you want to share a link with us, just literally paste it right in that bottom part of the chat room, and all of us that are here, we're going to be able to see that link. So that was part of my job. Now, right below the chat room, we have two action alerts for the End Wars and Occupations team. We have one action alert that's our healthcare, not warfare alert. This is going to send an email directly to your congressman, either thanking them or spanking them for their support on H.R. 780 and H.R. 676. 780, of course, is Barbara Lee's a safe and orderly withdrawal from Afghanistan, and 676 is our expanded and improved Medicare for all. Barbara Lee just introduced a brand new bill 2 days ago, which basically calls for supporting diplomacy with Iran rather than a war solution. And that action alert is also embedded on this page. So you can either Facebook, Twitter, or email the action alerts, or just bring people directly onto our page. We've got 14 people in the chat room. I am absolutely delighted. I'm going to immediately switch hats, and then you're going to be rid of me for the night. With all the new technology that we are investing in with PDA, and yes, I am spending money so that we're going to be able to reach out and then give people tools to do the work that they need to do. There are so many things that we need to do as activists and as PDA. I'm going to ask everybody that's on this call, if you haven't already done so, please consider donating to PDA and becoming a sustainer. For $5 a month, $10 a month, it's really amazing what we can do with that money that we get every month. So that was basically the part that I was hired to do. So I'm going to mute unless there's any questions. You basically have 1 minute of questions with me, and then I'm going to turn it over to Sally and Virginia, who have an amazing call for you tonight.
Andrea, thank you.
You're very, very welcome.
And could I put in a little pitch here before Virginia? We take it back to Virginia.
Could I just ask Andrea where the Iran statement is? Is this on this page?
Yeah.
Yes, it is. It is directly below the chat room. It says action alerts. It's HR 4173. Support Iran diplomacy.
4173.
Those are the action alerts. But what about our Iran statement that we discussed last month?
Oh, your Iran statement is, if you scroll all the way down to the bottom of the page, it's PDA statement on U.S. government policy on Iran. That is still there.
Okay, thank you, because we're going to discuss that next. Thanks.
Okay.
Hello, this is Sally again. The leadership part of this IoT has come up with a campaign chiefly designed by Virginia Hofler. And we're hoping tonight in the chat room you may put your name and say you want to help with this campaign. I'm not going to go into much detail about it, but it involves making some phone calls, even if it's just a couple, to Congress people or Congress people's staffs. And we are almost at the point of launching this, and we could use more people to help. So it's about Barbara Lee's 780 getting us out of Afghanistan quicker. And so I'm hoping at the end of the call we'll have two or three or maybe a bunch more people to help us. So that's it.
Okay, thanks, Sally. Next, last month on our call we discussed the PDA Iran statement, and we asked for comments to it during the month, and we did get a lot of comments and some great suggestions. And I'm introducing Mark Levin, one of our kitchen cabinet members, as we call ourselves, that helps us run this IoT. And he's going to talk about the revisions we made to the Iran statement. Mark, are you there?
I didn't know I'd be asked, but maybe it's better to just be spontaneous anyway. Thank you very much to everyone who contributed. It was very helpful for us to help us refocus the statement in a way that emphasized what diplomacy really is in our eyes and how it's really related to forging peace and not just the usual way that the U.S. State Department handles it. And we also addressed the issue of a nuclear Iran a little bit differently, basically pointing out that they would not be alone among the world of countries that have had nuclear weapons for quite some time, and none of which have ever used them other than the United States. And this was in the notion that idea should not necessarily be kept off the table, and that's important to mention because it seems to be at the heart of the saber rattling of the administration right now. And so those were the major revisions, and I really appreciate those folks who took the time for some very thoughtful comments.
Thank you, Mark. As Andrea said, that you can get to that statement towards the bottom of the page, right above Tom Hayden's picture is the link. So our next, we want to spend a few minutes with Sandy Davies, who's going to give us an update about what's going on in Syria. Sandy, are you available?
Yes, yeah. So I'll try and be brief because I know we want to hear from Medea about the drones, but of course this is all connected. Today on the radio I heard a Syrian journalist who writes for Le Monde Diplomatique in France and who's working with the Syrian National Council. That's basically the conglomeration of different groups in exile. It's one of the three major opposition groups in Syria. And he's working with them to draft their kind of position statement on various issues, kind of the way some of our Occupy movements have here, just hashing out ideas and trying to come to consensus on what they actually want. But the one thing he said that struck me very, very firmly, he said, Syrians and Arabs more generally will not accept that the end result of the Arab Spring be determined by the United States, NATO, and their very undemocratic allies in the Persian Gulf. And yet, here we are. We have, in just over a year, we have gone from nonviolent revolutions that toppled two U.S.-backed dictators in the Middle East to two very violent conflicts that toppled two governments that the U.S. had wanted to topple for a very long time. Well, they haven't toppled the Baathist government in Syria yet, but that's kind of where the focus is right now. And so, we have to, we really have to ask ourselves, how did this happen? At the beginning, the U.S. and its allies were clearly completely blindsided by what was happening in Tunisia and Egypt, and yet somehow they sort of regained control of the agenda and the narrative. They backed the Saudis going into Bahrain and in invading that little country, and they managed to have transitions in Egypt and in Yemen that essentially leave the governments in place without their former leaders. And then we have Libya and Syria. And I just want to quickly read you something. This was quoted in an article by Alistair Crook that I put out on the Google group last week about Syria. But this is actually, these quotes are actually from a piece written for the U.S. Army War College in 1997 by the assistant to the Deputy Chief of Staff for Intelligence of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. And this is about U.S. information warfare. And what he said was, quote, "One of the defining bifurcations of the future will be the conflict between information masters and information victims." And then he went on a bit later, "We are already masters of information warfare. Hollywood is preparing the battlefield. Information seduces, betrays, yet remains invulnerable. How can you possibly counterattack information warfare others have turned upon you? Our sophistication in handling it will enable us to outlast and outperform all hierarchical cultures. Societies that fear or otherwise cannot manage the flow of information simply will not be competitive. They might master the technological wherewithal to watch the videos, but we will be writing the scripts, producing them, and collecting the royalties. Our creativity is devastating." And Alistair Crook went on in that article to talk about, fairly credible evidence that some of the reports coming out from activists in Syria have been fabricated. A group called Avaz has sent in computer equipment and video equipment that has then been used to put out reports on Al Jazeera and on CNN. The Syrian government and state media have now got a hold of video of these people preparing for an interview with Anderson Cooper, where you can see them. So, there's no fighting going on. They're wrapping some bloody bandages on a child, and then they're playing recorded, warfare sounds in the background as they're talking to Anderson Cooper. And, there are several other videos out there like this. We have to be very, very wary of, how our views are being manipulated. I think every activist feels very, very deeply for the activists in Syria who are now caught up in the middle of a violent conflict, a violent civil war. Which is really being led by the Free Syrian Army, led by a colonel who defected from the Syrian military. The Saudis and the Qataris seem to be funneling in weapons to them. And this is really, you know, this is all just very disturbing. It's not what we want to see, or what I think anyone, any of that, you know, the nonviolent activists in Syria and throughout the Arab world wanted to see happening. I think the media has moved on from Libya to Syria. I mean, they had this absolute massive focus on Libya for a few months there, and then they moved on to Syria. But I think it's instructive to think about what happened in Libya. In Libya, Libya was subjected to the most violent, heavy, concentrated bombing campaign since Iraq in 2003. NATO conducted 9,700 airstrikes in 8 months. Even the NATO-backed government there acknowledges that at least 25,000 people were killed, which is far more than in all the other Arab Spring revolutions put together. And the, you know, the advance of the NATO rebels across the country was led by special forces from Britain, France, Jordan, and Qatar. It was Qatari special forces who blasted their way into the Bab al-Azizia compound in Tripoli. And the country is now a complete basket case. You know, the media has moved on to Syria, but what NATO has left behind it in Libya is just a completely broken, destroyed country, effectively ruled today by literally hundreds of independent militias with different tribal and ideological and religious loyalties. The part in the east where this began in Benghazi just declared itself an autonomous state within Libya. Of course, that's where most of the oil is. Amnesty International has documented that there are at least 8,500 detainees that they know of held by these various militias in horrendous conditions around the country. In Misrata, which is where NATO trained most of the rebels, and so these are the militias, you know, that really were the closest allies of NATO, Doctors Without Borders had to pull out because their staff were being used to resuscitate people during torture sessions. And so, you know, I think when we hear talk of Western military intervention, any kind of Western military intervention in Syria, you know, we have to understand that that's kind of what it would look like, something like that. And probably because Syria is a larger, a more populous, a more complicated place, probably it would be much, much worse than Libya, which is already a complete disaster.
Thank you.
And so, I'll wrap it up quickly. But basically, you know, I mean, for me, it was just it's been incredibly reassuring to hear the calm, firm voice of Kofi Annan saying firmly that nobody should be sending more weapons into Syria, that there should be no outside intervention by any foreign forces, and that he, you know, he is working on a plan for a ceasefire, first by the government and then by the Free Syrian Army, and then to a political solution in that country. And you know, I think also, you know, we have to really understand that Russia and China, just after what happened in Libya, you know, this has been a turning point for them. You know, they are no longer going to give any legitimacy to, you know, to NATO's wars anywhere, probably. And but really, you know, I mean, all our hearts go out to the people of Syria and the people of Bahrain and Iraq and everywhere else where people are rising up against against these horrible governments. But we really, you know, as Alistair Cook said in that piece, you know, the correct response to the horrific death of a child cannot be to escalate a war that will just result in more children being killed. So that's my piece on Syria.
Okay, thanks, Sandy. It's very important that we all keep all these items in mind. There's so much going on there, and it's easy to get distracted from one to the other. So it's good to hear a report on that. If everybody could mute, I'd like to introduce now our featured guest speaker, Madea Benjamin of Code Pink and Global Exchange. She's just back from Bahrain. She'll be speaking on the U.S. military's increased use of drone warfare technology and how it's creating even more hostile views of our country. She is also the author of a new book coming out mid-April called Drone Warfare, Killing by Remote Control. Welcome, Madea.
Hey, thank you so much for having me on and for the great work that PDA is doing. And I enjoyed listening to the very important discussion right now about Syria and about the aftermath in Libya. It's so important to bring those issues up. And it fits right into this topic about drones. And Virginia and Sally, please let me know when I should stop talking. And how long do we have for the segment?
Well, we have a half an hour. We'd like you to speak about 20 minutes and leave some time for questions.
Okay, great. So I did this book on drones because I was so appalled by what I was seeing happening about the use of drones and discovered a lot in the process. One is I think we should recognize that drones in themselves are just a machine that can be used for good, can be used for bad. The people in the industry have been touting the good uses of drones. They like to bring up the fact that drones were used to fly over the Fukushima nuclear power plant when it was too dangerous for manned vehicles to fly there. There are environmental groups that are using drones out in the oceans to try to track down whaling ships that are illegally whaling. There are many people in the forestry industry that would like to see drones used to help with forest fires, to fly into the eye of a storm when there are hurricanes, to be used to drop humanitarian aid. There are some and potentially more positive uses of drones, but what is really driving this industry is not that. It's using drones for spying and for killing. Right now, the Air Force has been in charge of drones in the places that we have been at war. Iraq, Afghanistan, Libya, most recently. And the CIA has been using drones in places where we are not at war. That includes Pakistan, Yemen, Somalia, and more recently, the Philippines. The CIA is often working in conjunction with the Joint Special Operations Command of the military and also with private contractors who are involved at every single level of using drones, including pushing the button. The one of the issues that comes up when the military is using drones and separately the CIA is using drones is that Congress has no overview of the entire use of drones, because those used by the military report to the Armed Services Committee, whereas those used by the CIA report to the Intelligence Committee, and they purposely keep different hit lists of who they're going after and purposely keep Congress in the dark about the totality of the program. One of the amazing things, I think, under the Obama administration is that while Obama campaigned that he was going to close Guantanamo, he hasn't closed Guantanamo, but he hasn't put new people into Guantanamo either. And that's because instead of capturing suspected militants and putting them in prison in Guantanamo, the Obama administration is simply killing them. 85% of the drone strikes that the U.S. has undertaken have been done under the Obama administration. One of the reasons that is put forward that drones are better than manned vehicles, manned aircraft, is that they are cheaper. The average drone can cost somewhere between $5 million and $30 million, depending on the bells and whistles that it has. These are the Predator and the Reaper drones. There is a more expensive drones like the Global Hawk. That's a big, bulky drone used for spying. But the ones used for carrying out lethal attacks are under $30 million. This is often compared with things like the F-35 that are about $150 million. The price can be misleading for many reasons. One is that the drones tend to crash a lot. The Air Force has admitted that a third of their drones have crashed. You probably remember the quite recent downing of a drone in Iran, but this happens all the time. Drones also go rogue. The programming can be out of whack, and they can start going in a totally different direction than they were programmed to go in. Another issue that rarely comes up is that it takes a lot of personnel to run a drone. It's counterintuitive. You would think because they're not manned, you can save money on the personnel, but you actually need more. It's estimated that you need about 180 people to run one Predator Reaper drone, because you need not only the pilots who are based thousands of miles away in places like Creech Air Force Base or Langley, Virginia, but you need the sensor operators who are also based with the pilots. But you need people on the ground to maintain the drones, to send them off, to land them. And you need lots of people to go over the massive amounts of data that the drones are collecting while they're up in the air. Another reason given for the preference of drones is that they can linger in the air for a long time. And they hover over suspected targets for hours at a time just watching. And that's supposed to make them more precise. And the U.S. government claims that these are extremely precise, in fact, deny civilian casualties. Of course, we will never know the numbers of civilians killed because the U.S. government doesn't count civilian casualties, and most of the drone strikes are happening in the areas of Pakistan that journalists cannot even get to. But there have been thousands of people killed by drone strikes. There are different estimates, and I use different ones in the book and say the pros and cons of each. But certainly, we should assume that every time there is a drone strike, there are civilian casualties, and even the people who are called militants by our government, we should be very wary about who they are, because there is no proof. The U.S. likes to tout the killing of very high-profile people, but most of the people killed are oftentimes either civilians or low-level Taliban fighters in Afghanistan, or simply people who are living among the fighters and are relatives of them, because a lot of these drone strikes are happening while people are in their homes sleeping. One of the big problems of drones is that they are easy to replicate and easy to sell because they are, quote, relatively cheap. So that now there's over 50 countries that have drones. The biggest producer of drones is the United States. The second biggest producer and user is Israel. And we just saw in the last couple of days how they used them again in Gaza. And China is third and coming up quickly on the heels of the U.S. and Israel. China and Israel don't have many restrictions when it comes to selling their drones overseas. The U.S. still has some restrictions on that, and so there will be in the years to come much, much more proliferation. And speaking of proliferation, we have to look here at home. There are already drones that are being used on the Canadian and the Mexican borders. These are obviously not the killer drones, but they're spy drones. And there has been a tremendous push for the Federal Aviation Administration to open up the U.S. airways to drones. Right now, because of safety concerns, the FAA has been quite modest in giving out permits for the use of drones. But the Drone Caucus in Congress, which has 50 members, is extremely active and has just pushed through a piece of legislation that was signed by President Obama on Valentine's Day, February 14th, which forces the FAA to fully integrate drones within the U.S. airspace by 12/15 at the latest. And there is a push for that to happen even earlier. Just about every police department in the U.S. wants to get their hands on drones. Firemen want to get their hands on drones. Journalists would like access to drones. There's all kinds of people that would like to be able to use drones, and it is very disconcerting that the police might well, in the next year or two, be using drones in all sorts of ways to spy on people like ourselves. And finally, I wanted to mention that what goes around comes around, and fact that it is easy to take a model airplane and load it up with explosives was brought home to us in 2011, where somebody that was enticed in the United States by the FBI to get involved in terrorist activities was about to hit the U.S. Capitol with a homemade drone that he had made as an engineer, and blow up the Capitol Dome. So it is very easy for somebody who wants to harm us to get their hands on drones as well. And I guess I would end by saying that not only do we have no oversight over these drones, they are against international law, they make war easier. Certainly, the going to war in Libya, the Obama administration said they didn't need to go to Congress because no U.S. personnel would be in harm's way because we were going to be using drones, and that they don't work in the long run. If you look at the drone strikes that we have been doing in Pakistan, Somalia, Yemen, we create more people who hate us every time we drop a bomb than we kill supposed terrorists. And so for all of those reasons, I think it's something of great concern to us. There are people around the country, and maybe some of you on the phone, that have been protesting at bases where drones are being operated or being tested. We have Gene on the phone who's doing an amazing job trying to stop her part of the country from being used to test drones. We have people who are protesting at some of the companies that are making the drones. All over the country, there are research centers at universities and other centers that are getting Pentagon money to do research on drones. So there are plenty of places for us to protest. Some people think we should start out saying that drones should be taken out immediately from the hands of the CIA. That would be a good start. Others say that we should start by forcing the government to do a body count of who's hurt by the drones and be more transparent, like the ACLU and the human rights groups are calling for. Others who are involved in robotics say we have to stop what is yet to come and even worse, which is use of drones that are totally autonomous, that don't have a human, quote, in the loop. And others would say we've just got to make a clean call for an end to the use of lethal drones and go for some kind of international convention that would regulate the use of drones. So that's kind of the overview, and be interested in taking some questions.
So, Medea, this is Virginia. I have been to Creature Force Base, and I know there's other people here on the phone that have been to protest these drones. Do you hear much? You think those protests are doing good, that there's more people are becoming aware about what's going on?
I think those protests are absolutely essential, and I think we have to get more of them going on across the country as more bases are being used to operate or train pilots or test the drones. I think it's one of the few ways that people are getting more information about the drones, and certainly important to educate people in the community about what those bases and our lands are being used for.
And I understand there's a drone action in is it in Washington, D.C. At the end of April?
So Code Pink, along with the Center for Constitutional Rights and a group in England called Reprieve that has been legally supporting some of the victims of drone attacks in Pakistan, have come together to organize a drone summit in Washington, D.C. from April 28th and April 29th. This will be the first time that we bring together activists and human rights advocates and experts in the scientific community, along with people in the legal community, to look at the full extent of the use of drones and to talk about what realistically we could try to stop. And so I encourage anybody who's on the call to come to Washington if you can, to let other people know about it, because I think this will be a very historic gathering, and hopefully will set a course for some common campaigns that we can do in this country and with our partners overseas.
All right. Are there any other questions for Medea? Be sure to unmute.
It's Gina Gare. Medea, thanks so much for this overview and for all of your great work just accumulating what is going on with drones, and for everyone here too. You know, it's hard to even know where to begin, isn't it, because they have the entire technology has been so proliferated worldwide before we even really became aware of it, right? So it's tough to know how to bring this all back into place. We are laying the groundwork to make the drones subject to the national, domestically, to the National Environment Policy Act, which is at its heart a public disclosure law, so that at least they would be forced to, you know, as imperfect as the system is, to have to go through a process evaluating a drone's impacts and disclosing those before use. Now, of course, National Environment Policy Act is a public disclosure act, is being dismantled readily across the board. But that's just one more way that we're exploring and trying to lay some basic groundwork domestically.
Well, I think that's really important, and I just applaud the work that you're doing, Dean. And you started out saying how much proliferation has happened before we even knew about it. And that is true, and there is so much money now to be made in this drone industry. It's become a multi-billion dollar industry very quickly in the last decade. A decade ago, the Pentagon really didn't have drones, maybe about 50 of them. Now they have 7,500. Most of these are smaller drones. They're making drones that soldiers can put into their backpacks and launch from there. But there are literally thousands and thousands of drones that the military now has. And the drone industry has a very strong association that it has already built up with thousands of companies that make particular parts of these drones. Just like we see with any big military hardware, the manufacturers are very smart. They make different pieces of it in different states around the country so they can get more congressional support for it. And that has happened in the last 10 years so quickly. There's a professor in Iowa that just was concerned about drones and did a Freedom of Information Act to see what was being done in his state and found all kinds of connections to the drone industry. And there's nothing special about his state. He said if you looked at any state and got that information, you would see how many companies and research institutions are involved with drones. And so the pressure on this industry is very strong. I talked to Jody Williams, who is the Nobel Peace Prize winner for her work around banning landmines. And she is very, very concerned about drones, but said that you'll never be able to stop drones the way they were able to stop landmines because the industry is so big, so powerful, so much money is being invested in it. She said landmines were chump change compared to the money going into drones. So, yes, the cat is out of the bag, and it's going to be very hard to regulate this industry.
And across the board, I mean, in our experience in southern Colorado and northern New Mexico, which has been really targeted to be the transformation war training center area for drones, very remote, as they dismantle the external, the Pentagon and the Army dismantles any external oversights, as is already demanded by public law, as they dismantle that and bring all of their operations within private contractors who have absolutely no rules on them, no obligation to disclose anything, and these close partnerships with the Pentagon. We also, at the same time, see, as Medea talked about, the takeover of the universities, particularly land-grant universities, which, of course, are the biotech and nanotech research institutes. So we've had people in the Pentagon tell us that there are payloads being developed that are biotech and nanotech for the swarm drones. If we don't have public accountability and demand for what is actually coming into our environment on these drones, I mean, it's like you say, we can't stop it. How do we start to put rigor around the containment and the requirements? I hate to say that. I hate to admit that we will not be able to stop it, but it is so prolific globally, I don't see any way we could go for a stop. I mean, we could stop the 51st state, this area that they're trying to take over, and that's essential for this drone development. We can have some retarding effect on the drone development that way. But in terms of the bigger picture, we've got to preserve this public disclosure. And truly, the United States only has two public disclosure laws, the Freedom of Information Act and the National Environment Policy Act. Maybe we need to make a new one. I don't know. I don't know.
Thanks, Jeannie.
This is Alfie in Central Jersey. And, Medea, I think you said something about a law that was recently passed concerning drones and airspace. And if you could just say that again or elaborate
yeah.
that if I got that right.
President Obama just signed into law a call for the Federal Aviation Association to fully integrate drones within U.S. airspace by 2015. The FAA and the pilots have been very reluctant to see the proliferation of drones in the U.S. because they consider them very unsafe. There's nobody in the cockpit to look around and see, is there another plane close by? And because these drones also crash so much, they're worried about the drones falling down onto into people's houses. But because of the strength of the drone caucus, they did get this legislation through. So by 2015, they have to integrate drones into the airspace. And even within 90 days, they have to allow for very small drones to be used up to a certain height in the U.S. But it's part of this push to quickly allow for drones in U.S. airspace.
And the drone caucus is people who love drones in the Congress, or what?
People who take lots of money from the industry.
Exactly. It's a direct correlation for that. So it's pretty disgusting to see them in Congress. You'll see a drone fair literally in the middle of Congress. Every year they come and have displays and say how great the drones are. I mean, there's this very insidious connection between the congressional representatives and the drone industry.
And so they got the majority of Congress to agree with them and pass this bill, which Obama
yes.
has signed.
Yes.
It was truly a wild mix of legislators. So it was the Democratic Senate, and it was then a lot of congressmen, Democratic congressmen on the House side, voted against the FAA bill. But they made up for it with not really Tea Party people, but industrial state Republican representatives.
Medea, this is Sandy in Miami.
I'm thinking about a couple of things. First of all, that the safety issue sounds overwhelming. I mean, that drones crashing all over the United States sounds ridiculous. That safety has got to come first. We can't have the people who are defending the country crashing drones into our houses. That's nonsense. So that's got to be a strong argument somewhere. And second of all, if they're going to have drones, then I think we should have drones. We should have PDA America should have its own. ABC News should have a drone. We should be able to spy on the people who are spying on us. If they're going to spy on us.
Don't say it too loud. A contractor will give you one.
Well, let me say there that we bought their drones, little toy drones you can buy. I have somebody gave me one of those. The Occupy Wall Street bought its own drones. In Poland, the activists bought a very sophisticated drone and have flown it over the heads of the police as they're in their protest to see what the police are doing and planning. So, yes, we should be able to have our own drones, but I think we would prefer that nobody have them.
And the third thing I'm thinking just off the top of my head is if they're going to spend money like this, then we ought to ask for offsetting troop reductions if they can, you know, increase equipment manufacture on such things as drones, and we ought to be able to bring the soldiers home who are overworked and overstressed and going nuts, get them off the battlefield. Ask for some compensation.
Well, I'd be really careful with that argument. So this is Gina. Play a little devil's advocate with you about that. So one of the founding neocon ideas behind transforming the military, which is really bringing the military into the robotic era, was that, and this was the neocon rationalization, it takes humans out of harm's way of war. And so the Obama administration is advancing this idea in a very big way. because the military is rapidly becoming a secret black ops military. And I don't think we want that in a democracy. You know, war has not been deterred by having people in harm's way. But to argue, I mean, this is an argument that's being advanced by some of the administration. This is they're buying into the neocon argument. Let's take humans out of harm's way of war with drones.
Well, then maybe you
humans meaning American.
Argument where we could say, let's get away from an all-volunteer army and make everybody join the army. Then there are no secrets. We all
now there you go. There you go. That's probably something we do need to revisit again as citizens' army, because we wouldn't get into so much in trouble probably.
Maybe.
Okay. Is there someone else that wants to ask or
Sandy?
Comment?
Yeah. I have a question for Medea. I'm just wondering if anyone is making any progress in learning how to shoot these things down.
Well, yes, they're being shot down more and more. It was the Iranians say they are able to shoot them down. There were drones that Hezbollah got hold of, and they supposedly also shot down Israeli drones, and Israeli shot down their drones. So they're seem to be quite easy to shoot down.
Okay, well, that sounds like good news to me.
Well,
I mean,
it's not really good news.
Ultimately, I mean, that's how the weapons evolve. I mean, then the response to that weapon is to learn, you know, develop another weapon that will shoot it down. And if the weapons for shooting them down get good enough, then that kind of renders the whole thing useless.
Well, no, because right now what they're doing is developing drones that can fly higher, that don't make noise, that are resistant to being shot down. So, you know, the technology works both ways.
Yeah, okay.
I would be very cautious about the danger of drone envy.
Mm.
Yes.
Mine's bigger than yours.
I think that's the voice of Michael Eisenshur, correct?
yes, I recognize that voice.
Well, thank you very much, Medea. We really appreciate your being here. Be sure to stop by in Phoenix if you're doing a book tour. We'd love
to have you. That's the other thing I did want to say is that the book is coming out in mid-April, and I would love to hear from any of you that might be interested in having me come to your community and give a talk. And if you are interested, just drop me a note, Medea@globalexchange.org. And thank you so much for having me on the call and for all the great work you all are doing.
This is Althea. I just have one more question for Medea. I had heard this week on the news that the Obama administration agreed to some sort of egalitarian use of space with regard to weapons, and then John Bolton, you know, wrote some very denunciatory op-ed about it. Do you know anything about that?
No, I'm sorry, I haven't followed that.
Okay. Thank you anyway.
Virginia, this is Sally. I want to say something. I think maybe Andrea might have omitted. I'm a big advocate of that we now have a forum. And if you go a little, if you were able earlier to get to where Andrea was, on our IoT, our EWO and war and occupation, IoT, then it's on the PDA community website, pdacommunity.org. Just below what she was telling us is something called EWO latest forum posts. And my dream is that at some point we will not just have monthly calls, but we will have an exchange of views with this forum, tomorrow and through the month, and then and that will also help us who plan these calls know what you're interested in. So I urge you to try to find that. And I'm not very good at explaining the whole technology, and I want to put in one more pitch. I have not actually followed the chat room tonight, but I hope some of you that are on this call might volunteer through the chat room, the forum, contact Virginia or me. I have a PDA email called n-war@pdaamerica.org. Try to get hold of one of us to say, I would like to help with the Barbara Lee 780 campaign, and we will be glad of your help.
Yes, and while you're here, right underneath the chat and right above the forum, please be sure to click into those action alert items, the Healthcare Not Warfare, and then below that, the HR 4173, which supports diplomacy with Iran as opposed to war. We need everybody to sign on to those two action alerts. Thank
and
you.
Maybe and we could end with fundraising. Is Change Makes Change on our... It's
great part of the right.
Speak up. Speak.
On the gray bar at the top near the... on the gray bar to the right, we'll find a listing for donate. You click on that. It gives you a form to fill out to join the Sustainer program, Change Makes Change.
Undertake action. Yeah.
Virginia, Carl, who just spoke, and me, Sally, were recently at a leadership conference of PDA in Winslow, Arizona. And we know how much this organization does with so unbelievably small an amount of money. And what we want is to have like a couple of field organizers beyond Connor and Andrea. There's two more people that were hired for 1 month. And if we could keep on, and that month will expire soon. If we can keep on, $10 a month, I think, is the sort of the minimal ask, and or a one-time donation, any of those things. Anyway, look for Change Makes Change. Well, PDA needs some financial help to do what we're doing.
Yeah, look for a donate button on any of the websites. You'll find it.
Thanks, Carl. Okay, so who's left on the line? What do we got here?
Sometimes we stay on after 10 o'clock.